It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you a man who, in my short acquaintance with him, has proved himself to be worthy of the high responsibility that has been placed upon his shoulders in recent months. Dr. Pakala, as you know, is the distinguished successor to Dr. Jesse Ziegler as the executive director of the Association of Theological Schools of the United States and Canada. I believe there are 194 of us schools this year, and all of the problems that we have at Concordia with curriculum and finance and dealing with minorities and all of these things, if you multiply that times 194, and you get the full measure of Dr. Pakala's enormous task. According to my very brief biographical notes, Dr. Pakala is a graduate of Colgate Rochester Divinity School. I did his doctoral work at Yale, which is a pretty good school. These people give me a bad time about having gone there. It's good to find another one. He has had a distinguished career in education, having served at DePaul University, at Bucknell University for a number of years, where he was not only chairman of the department, but dean of the Division of Arts and Sciences. He was president of Colgate Rochester from, 1973 until this position. And he now serves as the executive director of the Association of Theological Schools. I understand that his main areas of academic interest are systematic theology, which further endears him to me, as well as the history of philosophy and aesthetics. Dr. Pakala, we greet you, and we look forward to hearing you speak to us on theological education and the challenges of continuity.
Thank you, President Bowman, for that very warm and gracious introduction. Quite different from what I was used to when I was present. As you know, President had the task of addressing so many graduates and how frequently I was introduced in this rather cursory way. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll hear the latest dope from the seminary. When John Potts invited me to participate in this event, extended that invitation so graciously last summer, he was really buying a pig and a poke. I accepted with uncharacteristic alacrity. I did so for a number of reasons. First of all, for a very personal reason. As a youngster growing up in Indianapolis, the son of immigrant parents who had left their native Orthodox church to become Baptists, I lived in a very simple ecclesiastical world, one side of which was occupied by Protestants, and by this I meant Baptists and maybe a few Methodists. I lived in the wrong town to encounter either Presbyterians or Episcopalians, so they didn't figure in that world. At the other end of the spectrum of that world, of course, were the Roman Catholics and the Greek Orthodox, and somewhere in between were the Lutherans. Now, for me, that meant Missouri Lutherans, because that was the only Lutherans I'd ever met. Where in the middle they were occupied was a mystery beyond my own probing. I'm personally very pleased to be in this center of Missouri Lutheran scholarship, learning, and piety. It will enhance my knowledge and also correct that worldview. I have also a more serious reason for accepting that invitation. It gives me an opportunity to become personally acquainted with one of the very significant resources for theological education in our nation. The long traditions of education that this school represents, your distinguished service to your constituency is well known. And I come really not only to acknowledge that in an official way in my new office, but also to serve notice that I will look upon the school not only with the expectation of continued excellence and service to your own constituency, but also with increasing expectation of what contributions this school will make to the profession itself. I level that second order of expectation only in acknowledgement of the resources that you represent and the possibilities that you truly possess. So I'm serving notice that henceforth you'll be graded not only by one but by both of those expectations. For the last 5 months, I have moved across this nation in an effort to get a personal impression of our theological schools, something of their status, something of the forces which are at work shaping them, and also of the leadership of those schools. It's been a very demanding experience, both physically and intellectually. I think I'm doing better on the first of these than I am the second, because I'm finding that the experience is something of an intelligence test, given the diversity of theological education in this nation, and I'm not scoring very high on that test. But it has been a truly remarkable experience. It has given me a chance to try to discern something of the temper of our times and something of an opportunity to generalize about the state of the art. And though I need a good deal more time to reflect and to assimilate that experience, I'm convinced that perhaps one of the ways to grab hold of it is by recognizing that despite the differences of predicament and situations of our various theological schools, that there is a sense in which all of them are being moved by an increasingly clear vision of the challenges of continuity. And there's a sense in which the motivating forces at work in our theological schools can be summed up in the question, what does it mean to be a seminary in these days and in our circumstances? And I'm going to use that question to try to generalize about some of the ways in which our schools are viewing those challenges of continuity or the kinds of responses that will be required of our schools in the years immediately ahead. Now, first a comment or two about the shape in which those responses are appearing. You know, it wasn't long ago that every social institute, majority of our social institutions operate on the assumption that only by radical rebirth could viable institutional life continue. It was the myth of Osiris at work here that only out of the ashes of the past could the institution continue with any sense of relevance and effectiveness. I don't find that myth at work today, by and large. There's a sense, really, that our task of the continuity of the community of faith really is not to renounce the past, but to reaffirm it in ways which will be instructive and supportive. And so I do not find the myth of Osiris a very helpful form in which to shape the challenges of continuity before our schools. The reverse of that, however, poses another issue. It seems to me that the problem, the temptation today, is not that of renouncing the past, but of interpreting continuity as mere perpetuation. I think that's a much greater danger for our schools for a whole host of reasons, some of which we'll have a chance to consider. In any event, somewhere between continuity as radical rebirth and continuity as mere perpetuation, the answers to the immediate future will be forthcoming. I want to begin with a few observations about the agents of theological education, namely the institutions themselves, and I want to end with what is, I'm sure, much more important to all of us, some comments about the enterprise itself. Now, first of all, some remarks about theological schools as such. In the Carnegie study, 2000 Futures, the study of higher education in this country, Clark Kerr begins with a chapter entitled Base Point 1980, in which he attempts to set at rest several myths which are obviously at work regarding higher education. Well, I think something like that is quite helpful and instructive regarding theological education itself. First of all, I'm convinced that theological schools begin the 1980s in much stronger position than they began the 1970s. By and large, the leadership of our schools face the future with that confidence. Now, let's look at the reasons or some of the sources for that confidence. Well, first of all, we are part of a much larger enterprise. Enrollments have increased some 60% over the decade, and it's a much more complex constituency than we served in the 1970s. There are over three times as many women involved, over 153% more blacks, and an equal percentage of increase in Hispanics. It's also a much more complex constituency in terms of age, in terms of personal motivations, in terms of the kinds of backgrounds and situations that our students bring to our campuses. Secondly, it's a more complex operation. It is a more diverse in addition, our theological schools are moved by a plurality of purposes, which is much broader, much more inclusive than was the case in the 1970s. We are serving not only those who are preparing for ministry, but we are seeking to sustain those in ministry. We are seeking to widen the educational needs and purposes of the church to which we are applying the resources of our theological schools. Furthermore, as institutions in our society, I feel that theological schools are much more resilient, much better organized than during the 1970s. As a result, in part, to responding to certain problems and crises that confronted us during the past decade. Financially, we're sounder. We began the 1980s much stronger financially than we began the 1970s. In 1970, theological education had a corporate deficit of over $5 million. We ended the decade with a positive balance in excess of $3.5 million. The first 7 years of the decade were deficit years. The last 3 years were years of positive balances. So you see the trend, the profile there, confirms the fact that we encountered financial difficulties of various proportions during the 1970s, and theological schools did something about it. Generally, the state of our schools are much stronger than the 1970s, and that is the cause for a good deal of caution and knowing optimism about the future. And I must say that one of the very pleasant surprises of my early months in office is that I find much less of the forecasts of doom than I found in other echelons of higher education among our theological schools. Our leaders are, by and large, quietly confident, knowingly optimistic about the future. That is not to say that they are blind to the problems, but by and large, knowing what the challenges are, there is a good deal of confidence about the future, and that is a very important note to sound. And now, a further comment or two about the theological schools themselves. First of all, as we look from the standpoint of the institutions at some of the challenges that will determine the immediate future, there are two or three which obviously come to mind and which may be of interest in singling out. First of all, more and more schools are aware that perhaps one of the more pressing challenges of the years ahead will be that of assuring a sufficient constituency for the institutions to serve. Now, it's a complex way of saying that schools are worried about future sources of students. If there is one source of greatest anxiety among the leaders of theological schools in our nation, it is located at this point. The uncertainty of the future as far as the potential source of students. Now, as we look at this challenge, the problems are in part generated by the successes of the past. I indicated that the 1970s were times of growth and expanding enrollments, by and large, for theological schools across this country. But the experience has not been uniform. Over a five-year period, for example, enrollments in New England increased some 5.4%, in the Middle Atlantic states, 3.6%, in the South, 48%, and in the West, 82%. And the Midwest somehow falls between divergent percentages. So depending on where one was, the experience of the decade in terms of enrollments varied. Furthermore, there was considerable variation among types of divinity schools themselves. Schools associated with many of our mainline denominations had a diversity of experiences, with some actually experiencing radical decline in enrollments. And the most radical, of course, were suffered by Roman Catholic theological schools, with the dramatic and very drastic decrease in the number of vocations, an issue with which they continue to struggle and which will shape in a very decisive way the immediate future of Roman Catholic theological education in this country. Other denominations have had a variety of experiences. Some of the schools, which particularly in the Northeast, have at best maintained their enrollments. Schools of an independent nature and circumstances, by and large, experienced radical growth. So the change in enrollment patterns over the past decade itself has been varied and diverse enough to pose different kinds of problems for the constituency. The problem is further complicated by future prospects. We know what the demographics of our populations will be. Jim McCord of Princeton has put it very graphically when he stated not long ago that every person who will be enrolled in seminary in the year 2000 has already been born. Now, like real estate, they don't make anymore. And we know something about the general characteristics of that generation of future seminarians. It is predicated that during this present decade, the pool of seminary applicants will probably decrease anywhere from 6 to 10%. By the end of the century, anywhere from 10 to 20%. We also know that these projections will vary according to location. The number of college students, for example, in the states of Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, it is predicted, will decline in number over the next two decades as much as 37 to 42%. And when you put those figures into the computations, you can see the cause for uncertainty. There's another factor which is also very crucial in trying to get some grasp of this issue. Of 111 schools that I have visited to date, I can think of only a half dozen who are contemplating a future with either a constant student body or a slightly smaller student body. All of the rest are planning a future, predicting a growth in their student populations. And by this growth, I mean a substantial growth. Some are modestly planning on a per annual increase of from 5 to 8% a year. Well, calibrated over a 5 or 6 year period, that's a substantial increase. But some schools are planning a future based upon a 100 and 200% increase in their student body. Now, granted that those percentages are off a very small base, but still in terms of percentages, when placed alongside of the projected profiles of our own populations were in for some problems. Now, from these various factors, I think a number of conclusions can be drawn quite quickly. For one thing, I think theological schools face an immediate future of increased competition for students. We'll find that especially in our relationship to the first professional degree, that is, for the Master of Divinity candidates. Theological schools, despite the increased purposes to which they are committing themselves, continue to understand themselves first and foremost by means of the Master of Divinity program. And therefore, in projecting a future, particularly a future concerning their student body, they're placing their emphasis at that level of their program. Furthermore, schools which historically have never emphasized the first professional degree are now beginning to do so. It's as if they are operating now on the recognition that in order for them to serve their specialized purposes, be it the preparation of the scholars of the church, for example, or some other, that that can best be done by strengthening the Master of Divinity program. So it's interesting to see how this emphasis upon this basic purpose around which our theological schools have historically shaped themselves, how this is will continue to work in the immediate future to complicate the matter of our serving constituency. Second, I think theological schools, in their search for students, will be tempted increasingly to shape their programs according to the marketplace. Now, this is going to be seen, or this will be worked out in a number of ways. For one thing, the battle of the numbers will continue to dominate the concern for quality. Now, the pressures are already there. Over the decade, for example, the percentage of operating budgets at theological schools, which has been supported by tuition and fees, has increased from 20 to 30% of the operating budgets. So that theological schools throughout this decade will be increasingly dependent upon numbers of students for support of their operations. Furthermore, the temptation to relinquish what prophetic role seminaries have accepted as part of their calling within their constituency will be continually challenged as the search for numbers takes its toll. And finally, I fear that even within the seminaries of a given church constituency, this competition for students will increase. We'll find, I'm afraid, seminary pitted against seminary within the same ecclesiastical group, increasingly competing for the same students. So, if that is a rather sober picture, I think justification in stressing it can be found in our need to be as realistic and as comprehensive in our concerns for the future as we possibly can in shaping that future. Let me move to a second issue that institutions will face as they seek to respond to the challenges of continuity. This is a different kind of issue, but it's going to be equally significant. I'm convinced that the future will be shaped by an increasing demand for theological schools to redefine their relationship to the rest of higher education. Now, this issue has a background that needs to be recalled. One of the most significant developments in higher education in this country since World War II has been the enormous increase in the number of departments of religious studies in our colleges and universities. It has literally changed the face of higher education in this country. Now, that movement has had, to date, at least two consequences for theological schools. A positive result has been that it has, if not forced, then freed theological schools to reconsider their mission and to concentrate upon their task and their mission as the church's academy. But there's also been a negative consequence. Because one can trace, most assuredly, an increasing dichotomy and gulf, a widening gulf between theological schools and the rest of higher education. Now, if permitted to continue, that increasing dichotomy will have a number of consequences. For higher education, as Dean Caragallo of the University of Chicago has pointed out recently, it will mean the threat of the trivialization of the study of religion in our colleges and universities, when that study is removed from the normative influences of a historic faith, then that threat is very real indeed. For seminaries, Caragallo pointed out, they will be denied the larger, more universal context of the study of religion by which to carry on their own instructional programs. Well, I think that the threats are even graver than that. I think that if permitted, if the kind of alienation that is so evident today between theology, between faculties of religious studies and faculties of theology, if that alienation continues, what this will mean is that in our universities and colleges, comparative study of religion will become normative, with the possible threat of the relativization of all of the study of religion. On the other hand, seminaries will be threatened with obscurantism of a most radical form, as they are cut from the shaping frames of intelligibility over which, like it or not, our colleges and universities preside. Well, now, what, if any, are the evidences for this fear? I must confess that I'm increasingly concerned about the evidences of the withdrawal of theological schools from involvement in the life and work of universities. I'm convinced that theological faculties are much less influential in the shaping of our secular disciplines today than 20 years ago. I was also concerned, as one reads theological school bulletins and talks with various leaders of our schools, one's concerned with the lack of awareness of the role that the schools must play in the nurturing of the church's knowledge of her scriptures and her faith. If scholarship, research, and publication are too technical terms, then let's just talk about the responsibility of preserving, of nurturing, of transmitting, of enlarging the church's knowledge of her scriptures and her history. Now, put that way, theological schools cannot abrogate the responsibility for that portion of the life and work of the church. And yet, the educational task before us, important though it be, seems to be consuming and exhausting all of our efforts and our attention. Finally, one is alarmed by the evidences of what quite clearly are increasing deferral on the part of theological faculties for certain important areas of research. Not long ago, I did a quick, totally unscientific statistical study of what has been happening to along these lines, and analyzed some of our leading journals upon which our theological schools depend. I found some rather interesting results of that exercise. For one thing, if there are biblical scholars among us, I found that our biblical scholars are holding their own. For example, in the Journal of Biblical Literature, 20 years ago, 29% of the articles published that year were by members of theological faculties. In this last year, 40% of the articles were published by theological faculties. Now, before you pat yourself on the back, I want to study the data a little bit more. It may say more about biblical scholarship than it does about the problem that I'm really concerned with at this point. But be that as it may, we're holding our own there. But in other forms of scholarship, there have been drastic changes. 20 years ago, 34% of the Journal of Religion came from members of theological faculties. Last year, not a single article. 20 years ago, in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, 43% of the articles were published by theological faculties. Last year, 16%. Now, I don't want to push those figures too high because I know of how complex the matter is that I'm alluding to. Just the sheer change in numbers, the growth of departments of religious studies, the politics of editorial leadership, all these things have to be taken into consideration. But granted all of that, I think the data are sufficient to justify our concern lest theological schools separate themselves, not only from fields of learning that make up our universities, but also kinds of scholarship which have constituted a very important part of the life and work of our theological schools in the future. Because without careful attention to these aspects of our institutional life, we may be presiding over a quiet withdrawal, not only from influencing the future of the intellectual world of our society, but also the nature of the disciplines upon which theological education depends. The third issue. Theological schools in the immediate future will be challenged continually to redefine their relations to their constituent churches. Now, it's interesting to note that as I have talked with now over 100 of our chief executive officers of theological schools in our country, and asked them to single out some of the most important achievements of their institution in the last decade, invariably very high on their list is one that seems to be common to most of our schools. Namely, we have improved our relationship with our church constituency. Now, there's a consistency with which this response has come. Theological schools during the 1960s seemed to have suffered a period in which those relationships were either in decline or in crisis. During the 70s, they were concerned about them and did something positive and constructive. And as I said, time and time again, these presidents have singled out this achievement as one of the major accomplishments of their institution. When they were then asked to list some of their major concerns of the immediate future, some of the most thoughtful of these presidents have contended that they are worried lest the influences of their churches overly dominate the life and work of the schools. Now, I want to point out that these people are not talking about the problem of whether or not their schools are the academy of the church. They're talking about the necessity for preserving the ground upon which a theological school must stand if it's going to fulfill the mission that is laid upon it, the special mission laid upon it. They're talking about whether or not their schools will be able to have the kind of autonomy and the degree of freedom that they will need to discharge responsibly and fully that special mission laid upon them, or whether the immediate needs of the church, as conceived by, important though they may be and significant though they certainly are, those needs as conceived by the present leadership might not overly influence the vision with which theological schools operate. Well, that concern is there. How are we going to shape responsible denominationalism without incurring the dangers of increasingly secularizing theological education in this country? I think that's a serious problem, a very serious problem. And I think a school such as this, whose identity is not ambiguous, whose relationship to the church is not uncertain, I think a school such as this can exercise enormous leadership for the enterprise in coming to grips with that growing problem. What does responsible denominationalism mean in an age in which part of the task of theologically educating our constituency consists of preparing them for a church which will continually be challenged to seek its proper form of unity? I think that's an important problem, and I think it's an issue which this school can certainly take some leadership in. Let me, and I don't know what our customary time of ending is, but let me take a few more minutes to move now to something which really is more interesting to you than from the institutional perspective. And let me talk about two problems concerning the enterprise itself. I'm convinced that from the standpoint of theological education itself, now not conceived institutionally, but in terms of our enterprise itself, I'm convinced that the most pressing problems are theological ones. Now let me see if I can't identify hurriedly two of these. We're moving into a period when, both by mood, both by preparation and by preparation, and let me add a third, also by increasing need, schools are in a very reflective mood. They're moving to consider their enterprise not simply in terms of tempering with the mechanism of the curriculum, but with a need to rethink the foundations upon which the educational enterprise rests. And I'm convinced that as the 80s unfold, that concern at that level will continue to dominate the shape of our responses in the immediate future. Let me illustrate this in two ways. First of all, it's obvious that theological schools are moved now by a profound questioning of the basic purposes of theological education itself. What is that purpose? Are we called to prepare people to function in our society in certain ways? Or are we called to nurture bearers of a particular tradition? As we look at the history of our instructional program in the past decade and a half, that history has been increasingly dominated by the growth of the concept of ministry as a profession. A majority, if not most, of the changes in theological education in the past decade and a half have been as a result of the increasing acceptance of the premise that the ministry, like so many other callings in our society, is indeed a profession. Now, this perception of ministry as a profession is a relatively recent one. In 1899, William Rainey Harper wrote that it is the civic duty of theological schools to present the best practical training for a technical profession. End of quote. And it is that image of the ministry which has dominated the shaping of the educational enterprise of our theological schools throughout the past decade and a half. Now, I don't want to minimize the benefits of that development. When we cease impressing upon our students that it is largely by virtue of one's knowledge, skills, and competence that we have a right to minister in the name of Jesus Christ. When we stop doing that, then we fail our job in a very substantial way. So the professional model of ministry witnesses to a very important factor and a basis upon which we stand. But it seems to me the time has come for us to examine anew the adequacy of that model. And it may be that we need to mine again the more classical concept of ministry as a calling. And we need to find out how ministry as a calling would qualify or alter or enhance or add to the model of ministry as a profession. Now, this is basically a theological task. For there's a need to understand calling not only as a terminus ad quem, but also as a terminus ad quo. Not only a point of departure, but also that to which theological education points. For as Bart has pointed out to us, calling is not only something that happens in the very beginning, it's a constant claiming and reclaiming, awakening and a reawakening, a light and enlightenment and a constant enlightenment. For it is, as he writes, in its own manner and in its own place, no less a mystery than the Christmas mystery of the birth of the eternal Word of God in flesh. The miracle of calling is in its own manner and in its own place, no less than the Christmas miracle of the birth of Jesus Christ or the Virgin Mary, in which it has its pattern. Ministry conceived as a calling could have significant consequences for our enterprise. We need to mine those consequences and to ponder the implications for our educational task. A second issue that will increasingly challenge our future and our enterprise is what Professor Edward Fowler of Vanderbilt University calls the problem of the dispersed curriculum. In one published document, Fowler argues that theological education is in need of a new vision of the unity and structure of theological study. His thesis is that this is essentially a theological task, and it requires a new understanding of the object of theological study. Now, let's look at this. If I understand what Farley is saying, we certainly find evidences for this need at every hand. If there's one thing that students and faculty and graduates agree upon, it's that theological schools are afflicted by what Farley calls the dispersed curriculum. If your students are like students that I know, they complain unceasingly of the fact that there is very little, if anything, that holds together the diversity of their studies. And they long for some kind of frame of reference, some reality, some context, which will give them some sense of orientation and direction. If we listen to faculty in their moments of sobriety, and these are few moments indeed, they'll confess that their specializations isolate them from their colleagues. And we lose all sense of community of scholarship. If we listen to our graduates, and who can help but listen to graduates, they complain that seminaries are afflicted by yet another discontinuity between the study of academic matters and practical matters. If we listen to members who serve on curriculum committees, we realize that we require of curriculum committees decisions without any norms, decisions which they must make oftentimes by ad hoc arrangements, by political law ruling, or ad hominem results. There's an absence of any sense of accepted norms in the shaping and developing of institutional curriculums. Well, we haven't ignored these symptoms, far be it. Our curriculums have literally exploded in the last two decades out of our concern for these problems. On one hand, our curriculum has been shaped by the inner drive of the disciplines themselves towards increased specialization. And an interesting exercise would be to compare catalog of this school with the catalog 20 or 30 years ago and see how many more courses have been added to the curriculum. Since this has been going on, we've not only added courses because we needed to, quote, cover the field, end of quote, but we've been concerned about the fact that these courses have dispersed. And so we've added a layer of courses called integrated courses, we're going to put it all together again, though we continue to sort of pull it apart with our increasing specialization. As if that is not enough, we realize that it's not only necessary to integrate these courses, but we're also preparing people to practice ministry. And so to these courses that we've added practical courses of real significance and relevance. And the story goes on and on and on. No, we haven't ignored these symptoms. We've responded to them and responded to them in a multiplicity of ways. Now, it's interesting to ponder for a moment. The search for integration that all of us sense the need for probably witnesses to our, if not insight, at least our longing for the reality that pulls it all together. Furthermore, the drive to bridge the intellectual and the practical convinces us that there is a kind of knowing which includes the knowledge of guiding principles, the information of our disciplines, the competencies of our skills. And somehow we believe that theological education ought to represent that kind of knowing. Now, our curricular predicament has a long history, probably has several histories that we don't have time to analyze. Histories of the development of the disciplines themselves, the histories of theological education. But what does this all mean? Well, it means that this history has led us to a place in which we continue with a curriculum which no longer has a coherent rationale. It's a full curriculum which at one or some stages in the history of theological education probably made sense. It undoubtedly reflected a unity which we have long since lost. Ed Foley concludes, the dispersed curriculum of modern theological seminaries has displaced theological study of a unified subject with a plurality of studies, the relationships of which are problematic and the pertinence and justification of which to the practice of ministry are totally obscure. End of quote. Now, our problem in the years ahead will be to find a solution to this dispersed curriculum. I want to suggest that that's basically not a problem of curriculum. It's not a problem of the methods of teaching. It's basically a theological problem. Well, we've got to capture anew the object which nurtures, sustains, grounds, informs all of the individual studies that we now call the theological curriculum. And that is a theological task. I am not bright enough. I am not knowledgeable enough. I'm not wise enough to suggest a solution. But I feel increasingly sure of the elements of a solution and would want to challenge the entire community of our theological schools to consider seriously those various elements of the task. I'm convinced at one level that the task is a systematic task, that we need a doctrine of ministry which will clearly set forth what one can call the mandates of ministry that can act as norms for reconstructing the curriculum of our theological schools. It's a doctrine of ministry that's got to be inclusive, not simply of the ordained ministry, but of the ministries of the church as a whole. In all the talk about lay and ordained, I don't find enough concern, enough effort going into shaping a comprehensive doctrine of ministry. And without one, I feel we'll continue to be at loss to know the direction and the nature of our enterprise. second to that systematic test, and by the systematic test, I don't mean that it's just a task of systematic theologians, however important those special people may be. The process of the academic community, but a systematic task for all of us, biblical theologians, historians, practitioners, homileticians, exegetes. It's a systematic task that must challenge all of us. Secondly, there's an analytical task that must be done. By this I mean the subject matter which is the province of theological education needs to be constructed anew. We can't rest content with the fragmented state of the modern intellect. We can't rest content with allowing the guilds with their increasing specialization to determine the shape of knowledge upon which theological education rests. I feel that that task must be done from within what I've referred to earlier of the mandates of ministry. Now, that's a drastic charge. It may mean that we'll have to put it all together in different ways, which we're not accustomed to doing, given our training, given the methodologies that have been shaped, given the form and nature of contemporary knowledge. But I feel that that challenge is there. Thirdly, there is a curricular task to be done, and I think this will be the simplest of the three, and that is to rethink the sequence as well as the subject matter to be taught. And finally, there's an apologetic task to be done. Make sure that theological education does not isolate itself from the rest of culture. This result of the systematic and the analytical work must also be shaped by the question of how it's related to the rest of knowledge in the modern world. And that's an increasingly challenging and demanding task. Well, I'm going to stop there. You know, I started out by saying that I've been sustained in this journey by a discovery of the degree of quiet and knowing optimism on the part of our leaders of our theological schools, and I proceeded to lay out a long list of problems and challenges and predicaments and situations. I don't mean that to obscure or to cloud the future. I do mean this, however, by indicating that there's very important work, very challenging work that yet calls us, and I, for one, look forward to this decade, for I'm convinced that when it's over, it will be seen as one of the constructive and creative times in the history of theological education in this country. Thank you for your patience and your kindness.